Hey everybody, it is Sam back again. This will probably be the last time I say that, which is a little sad. In case you are not aware, this is the 10th letter that I have sent to Swamp Dweller, and it is the last one that he and I agreed upon doing together. Writing this feels surreal. It does not quite feel like the end yet, and I suppose it is not, because we still have the whole rest of this letter to go. So, let us get right into it. I will save most of the sappy stuff for the end, but I did want to briefly say that I really appreciate all the warm wishes and condolences that you guys gave me in the last letter. As I have said, it was a difficult one to write, and reliving those memories really hurt. But you guys kept reminding me of the positivity and light that there is in the world, and I cannot thank you enough for that. Much love from me and Serena to everyone who brought good energy and support on the last letter. You each mean a lot. Anyway, with that out of the way, let us get right into the last Q&A that I have for you guys. As usual, I tried to get the most important or common questions that you had, and hopefully, I did an okay job addressing those. So here we go. Is there a way to build bonds with certain cryptids? I feel a bit hesitant to answer this question, to tell the truth. This is not how to train your cryptid. However, this is an important thing to know, so I will be honest. Yes, there are ways to form bonds with certain monsters. If you have listened to my third letter, you may have heard how I helped a mother Sasquatch and her baby fight off a dog man. After that, the Sasquatch left a perfect circle of river pebbles on my front porch, as an expression of gratitude. At least I think. I would consider that a bond. As I have said before, many cryptids have also behaved a lot like animals, and just like you can form a bond with animals, you can form a bond with monsters. I will go into this topic a bit more with my second story in this letter, so stick around to hear more. Do I have any suicidal thoughts after losing Heather? Yes, I certainly did. Even though I did not talk about this explicitly in my previous letter. Heather's death was probably the hardest experience I have ever had to go through, and there were times where I did not want to carry on living without her. However, as I said before, I came to realize that her death was not wholly my fault, and there was more to life than just her. And things did get better, eventually. So, I am glad that I never gave in to those urges. Have I ever had to deal with rogue hunters or hunters gone bad? Yes, and I think I may have referenced this once in the past. It is a dark story, and I'm not going to go into it now. Maybe you will hear about it later. I will also add that there is a special group of hunters whose primary job is to act as enforcers and keep other hunters in line. Usually, they prevent incidents like the one I am talking about. Why don't hunters wear armor? This is a logical question that I have not really thought about explaining to you guys before. In the old days, I know some hunters in Europe and Asia used to wear metal armor, especially before guns were invented, or when guns were not readily available. But armor limits mobility. My mom often told me that the best way to withstand an enemy's hit is to not get hit in the first place. I think most hunters operate by this same principle. Not to mention that a lot of the time armor simply does not stand up to claws, fangs, and other natural weapons that a monster have. A Wendigo's claws will shred right through a bulletproof vest, and if you get pummeled by the fist of a Sasquatch, it really won't matter what you're wearing. For smaller creatures like chupacabras, I have worn arm guards and leg guards, but for most other monsters I have faced, armor does not really do much but slow you down. Some hunters deal with smaller or weaker cryptids with Kevlar or leather protective pieces, but it is incredibly rare that people wear a full suit of it. This was a good question, though. Alright, so that is all I've got for Q&A this time around. Thanks for listening so far. Now let us get into the actual stories for this letter. A few episodes back, someone asked a question about the monster known as the Kamazots. I did not answer that comment because these are the first monsters that I will be talking about this time. I briefly mentioned Kamazots in an earlier letter during a part of a Q&A section where I was discussing creatures that live in Mexico. I did not go into much detail on them, though, so do not worry if you missed it. Camazotz is a flying creature that lived throughout Central and South America, from Central Mexico down to Chile in Argentina. They have been reported by people in the southwestern United States as well, and they have been far away as the Pacific Northwest. However, it is incredibly rare for Camazotz to go so far north. Generally, they are found from the Mexico-US border and southward. Camazotz tolerate drier climates like deserts and can live in these areas, but they seem mostly to prefer subtropical or tropical environments and can be found in these types of regions all over Central and South America. What exactly Camazotz are is not entirely known. The name Camazotz itself comes from the Mayan mythology. In the Quiche language, the name literally means death bat, and some hunters call Camazotz death bats because of this. In the old Mayan epic myths and stories, the old Camazotz was vicious. It was a bat creature that lived in the underworld, and the hunters applied the name to similar species of cryptid. As I said before, it is not entirely clear what Camazotz is. In appearance, they seem somewhat humanoid, and they have characteristics of mammals and reptiles. The most basic description of what people would probably give a Camazotz is that it was a bat person. They stand slightly shorter than most humans, between 4.5 and 6 feet tall, with 2 human-like legs. These legs end in 5 claws, 4 in the front of the foot and 1 in the heel. The claws are made for slashing and tearing, but also for gripping onto things like perches or prey. Just like bats, Camazotz does not really have arms. Instead, their hands have developed into huge wings, with their elongated finger bones forming at the framework and web-like skin stretching over this. It's identical to bat wings. Bats are one of the only non-cryptids to have evolved this unique type of wing structure, so it is likely that Camazotz is related to bats somehow. Unlike bats, however, Camazotz has long, prehensile tails that end in sharp spikes. They use their tails to grip things, but also as weapons, stabbing out with the bone spikes like spears. Camazotz's final natural weapons are on their faces. A Camazotz's head almost resembles that of a furry crocodile, with huge, circular yellow-orange eyes and oversized bat ears sticking up on the sides of the skull. Their snouts are lined with sharp teeth, which they use to chomp and tear flesh. Camazotz's entire bodies are covered with short fur that ranges from brown to gray to black in color. The social system of Camazotz's is not well researched, but they have typically been seen in groups that hunters call flocks. Usually, these flocks number between 2 and 20 and live in very deep and remote areas of the forest, roosting in the highest cliffs, the deepest caves, and the tallest trees. Throughout the day, Camazotz roost in these hidden locations, before awakening as the sun goes down and flying out to find food. Large flocks tend to split up into smaller bands when hunting, oftentimes breaking off into mated pairs or sibling groups. Although they resemble bats in their appearance and many aspects of their lifestyle, their eating habits are one of the main areas where Camazotz are different. Whereas most types of bat eat insects, Camazotz prefer much meatier prey. Some hunter research seems to indicate that Camazotz often have their lairs near bodies of water for easy access to fish and waterfowl. They also target the birds and small mammals like monkeys and rodents. Camazotz will fly far in search of food, though, and this is where they usually become threatening to humans. They will raid villages and towns, taking domestic animals, livestock, and even people. Using their tail spikes, claws, and teeth, Camazotz can be ferocious, especially in numbers. Despite their size, they can also fly surprisingly quietly, and unless you are up or actually searching for them, you won't even know of their presence until it's far too late. Because of their aerial mobility, their nocturnal lifestyle, and their remote, hidden roost, not a lot of humans ever see Camazotz or even encounter them. But for the unlucky people who do fall victim to a Camazotz, well, it's usually not pretty. I have been on a couple of Kamazot hunts, but the first was in Brazil. This hunt was a strange one in some ways, mostly because it was not exactly planned. I did not even really, you know, have any time to prepare for it in advance. In fact, I was on a bit of a vacation when I got caught up in it. Things started when my friend Ray called me and invited me to his home in Brazil. Ray is from Venezuela originally, and he moved to Brazil as a young boy where he learned Portuguese and started working as a field guide and forest ranger in some of the dense, remote rainforest regions of the country. He developed close relationships with some of the local indigenous groups in the northern jungles and learned a lot from them. He did not believe many of their myths and folktales, though, until he saw the remains of some illegal loggers who had been killed by a pair of Ayara, the ferocious, fairy-like water woman of Brazil's rivers. Soon, a capital H hunter showed up from the city to speak with the aggressive creatures, and Ray was guiding her through the forest when the Ayara ambushed them. Luckily, both Ray and the hunter were armed, and together they killed the attacking cryptids. Impressed by Ray's gun skills and his knowledge of the environment, the hunter submitted him as a candidate for the organization, and when we offered him the position, he took it. Ray and I met at an interesting event. It is not often that hunters hold communal gatherings or events for the members who are not part of the lodge, but there was this one time that the organization had a big seminar-type event in the Mexican desert. A bunch of us were called to give lectures and lessons, often about how it's important to follow the knowledge and wisdom of native and indigenous people around the world when it comes to doing our job. My mom was lucky, or maybe unlucky enough to be selected as a speaker, so I tagged along with her and some other family members to attend the event. Ray was also giving a lesson there, and I found his piece to be both interesting and informative. I am not a great talker or a social butterfly, but Ray and I got along well and quickly got to know each other. He invited me to Brazil so that he could introduce me to some of the Indians there that he knew, and at first, I thought he was just throwing the offer out of courtesy. I accepted, not actually expecting anything to come of it. But around a year later, Ray got in touch and extended his offer again. I was not busy at the time, and since I have always loved to travel, I quickly agreed, and before long, I was in Brazil for the first time. Ray met up with me at the airport with his usual smile, wearing sunglasses, jeans, and a well-torn bucket hat. He looks like your average South American mestizo guy. Brown skin, a little lighter in color than mine, spiky black hair, and a lean build that is on the shorter side. Besides the various scars on one side of his face and neck, he looks like a surprisingly normal Latino guy. He gave me a big hug and helped me put my stuff into his red pickup truck. I do not know if hunters ever really drive anything besides trucks, honestly. Trucks just mostly have a lot of room for things, such as guns, some of which I had brought with me to Brazil. Ray had recommended that I take some weapons with me, partially because he wanted to see them, and partially because we would be going into the territory of jaguars and cryptids. I will not tell you exactly where I landed and where Ray picked me up from, but you probably will not find it on most maps. It was a small airfield in the northern part of the country, a few hours away from Ray's house. Ray took me there to first spend the night before we headed out to the forest the next day. Ray lives on a big plot of land near a small town in a rural area in this part of the country. As it turns out, he runs a small farm, which was surprising to me because he must be out hunting monsters so much. But he says he loves the farmer lifestyle, and he pays a few field hands to manage and oversee the crops, especially while he's out on the job. It seems to work out well enough. Anyways, the farmhouse is where we stayed the first night I arrived, before setting out for the jungle early that following morning. Ray's house is quite close to the edge of the forest, so it was not long until we were driving amongst the thick tree cover. The trees quickly became tall and broad, pressing in close on either side of the road. If you had listened to my 8th letter, the one where I talk about my encounters with the Ameletuca in the Congo, then you probably will have a good idea of what this forest in Brazil looked like. Even a whole ocean apart, these environments have a lot of similarities. We drove through the jungle for a while, talking with each other on and off, until we reached a point where the bumpy dirt came to a stop. Ray told me to wait in the car while he went to find the village we were going to visit and let them know we were coming. After a couple of hours, he came back and we went to the village together. The people we were visiting were members of the Yanomami tribe, one of the bigger and more well-known indigenous groups that live in the Amazon region. They have many communities in the northwest part of the area, and Ray has spent many times and many years getting to know them. The village we visited consisted of one big building that Ray told me was called a Shobono. This is like a huge U-shaped roof with a back wall made from leaves and reeds, supported by big logs that act as dividers between different sections. The whole village lives in this communal house. The whole structure sits around the edge of a cleared-out path in the jungle. When Ray and I walked up, most of the villagers were in the clearing surrounded by the Shobono, or sitting in the house itself. Photos and videos usually show indigenous Amazon people without much clothing, wearing only loincloth made of bark with their faces painted red, black, and yellow. And while it is true that many of the Yanomami people were dressed like that when I visited, there were just as many wearing t-shirts and sneakers. If they ask him, Ray sometimes brings them extra clothes, and they get clothes from other Indian groups too. Lots of the people motioned at me and started talking to each other when I came into the village. Ray introduced me to them in Portuguese, which some of the Yanomami people speak nowadays. Unfortunately, I only know a handful of words and phrases, so I had to rely on Ray to translate for me. After Ray introduced me and I repeated my name once more, the villagers seemed more at ease to approach me. Some of the kids were pointing at my wide-brimmed, camo-patterned safari hat, so I took it off and knelt to give it to them. They immediately started battling over it, which made the rest of us laugh. A couple of the adults and the other kids seemed surprised by my hair, which is a lot curlier than theirs. Ray told me that they were saying that I did not look like an Indian, so I had him explain to them that I was only half native. After a while, the initial excitement started to die down, and I noticed that some of the Yanomami had started standing back from the crowd. They looked unusually serious, and then I turned my attention to them. Everyone else got incredibly quiet. I quickly realized that something did not seem right, so I nudged Ray and gestured to the group of grim-faced villagers. One of them, a young woman, stepped forward timidly, her eyes flicking between Ray and the ground. When she got close, she began to talk to Ray in a halting, quiet voice. From her frequent pauses, it sounded like she did not speak Portuguese very well, but there was something else too. Her voice was like wavering. Her eyes were watering. When she finished talking, tears were running down her face, but she did not lose her composure. Ray turned to me. His expression had gone dark. "She says that she lost her daughter to monsters," he told me. My first reaction was confusion. "What do you mean, like cryptids?" I asked. Ray turned back to the young woman and asked her something. She responded, hesitating a lot and gesturing with her hands to help her explain. At one point, I clearly remember her flapping her arms up and down, obviously imitating the beating of wings. "Okay. She says she was out getting some vegetables from the crops 4 days ago. It was getting dark and her little daughter was nearby playing with friends. The kids must have been spread out. She heard a scream and then saw four enormous bats. Two of them had picked up her daughter with their legs. She says the children started screaming and then the bats and her daughter were gone over the trees," Ray explained. "Camazots," I said, and Ray nodded. The woman began to speak again, and Ray translated for me. Apparently, some of the village warriors, which there were quite a few of, had gone out after the Camazots after hearing the woman's story. They had returned empty-handed, unable to track down the creatures. Knowing that Ray was a hunter, the woman was now asking him to go after the Camazots and bring her daughter back. Ray explained that it was incredibly important to her, and even though she knew her daughter was probably no longer alive, this is because in their culture, the souls of the dead are only put to rest when their mortal remains are given a proper funeral. Usually, this involves cremating the bones of the dead. But of course, to do that, you need the bones. There are similar beliefs in a lot of cultures around the world, and I felt for this woman. In her mind, her daughter's soul would never find peace for all eternity unless Ray and I did something. These people did not usually talk about the dead, so the fact that this mother was sharing her dilemma with us was a rather huge event. "What do you think?" I asked Ray after he had finished explaining the situation.
"We need to do something.
Not just for this woman either. These Kamazots are eating children, for God's sake, they're aggressive," he answered. I agreed, but there was just one problem. I had studied up on Brazilian monster species before coming, but I've never hunted a Kamazot, I admitted. Ray smirked.
"There is a first time for everything," he replied.
With our course of action decided, the first step was to gather some information. First, we had to figure out where the Kamazots were roosting. We could not track them back to the place, of course, given that they could fly. We came up with the idea of setting up bait to lure the Kamazots in. But even if that did work, we would still only get a portion of what could be a larger flock, since Kamazots split up to hunt. Ultimately, Ray and I decided to ask for clues, starting with the group of warriors that had first tried to go out after the girl when she had been taken. After rounding up all the members of the search party that we could find, Ray and I asked them many questions about the surrounding region and their unsuccessful rescue mission. As it turned out, only about 6 of the men had gone out to chase down the Kamazots. The other 30 or so warriors of the village had been too scared of the monsters or simply unwilling to risk their lives to save one little girl. The small band that had gone to rescue had followed the mother's direction to gone east, the direction she had seen the Kamazots fly off in, but soon it had gotten too dark to continue and they had to turn back. The next day they had gone out to try again, but as they'd expected, there was not much trace of the girl or the dead bats. These were skilled hunters and trackers, and they knew these jungles better than anyone. If they could not find a single sign, then there was no way that Ray or I would be able to either. I was at a bit of a loss until I started thinking more broadly about the area. "They said the Kamazots flew east. What's over there?" I asked Ray, who relayed my question to the warriors. He looked puzzled as a few of them answered, using pantomime to fill the linguistic gaps. After asking a couple of follow-up questions, Ray turned back to me.
"It sounds like there's actually a cave in the east. Some of these men believe that the Kamazots may live there, but I think they are afraid of that area. They said their search party turned back before going that far," Ray explained. "That was a bit frustrating to me that warriors that were supposed to be brave had given up checking that area. But even the bravest people lose their nerve and abandon their goals sometimes."
"What's so bad about the cave area?" I asked. Ray's translation was quicker this time. "They say it's just a bad place, dangerous. I think they're talking about bad magic. I don't remember the words in English," Ray answered.
"Cursed?"
I suggested, and Ray snapped his fingers. "Yes, that's it. They did not say that, but I think they meant something similar. That cave could be where the Kamazots has their nest," Ray said. Ray and I decided to start our search there. The indigenous people did not have any rules forbidding us from going to that area, so hopefully we were in the clear. By that time, we finished collecting information and solidifying our plan. It was already almost evening. We hiked back to the truck in which we both had packed our weapons. Ray also kept a spare set of camping supplies and gear in his truck, as do most hunters. Among other things, this included a tap, a little single-person tent, and some food and water. I had brought my pack as well, which mainly held my food bag and water bladder. And, of course, we both had weapons. As per usual, I brought my rifle, shotgun, combat tomahawk, and a pair of knives. Ray was equipped with a rifle, a pair of matched pistols, I think they were Tauruses, a couple of knives, and an absurdly sharp machete. After taking stock of our supplies, we determined that we had enough materials to camp out and to get going the next morning. Without having to go back to Ray's house and pick up more stuff, we would head back to the village at dawn to request a guide. Hopefully, one of the Yanomami would be able to help us. Maybe one of them would be willing to at least lead us to the way of the caves. Between us, Ray and I had enough supplies to stay out to hunt for 3 days. After that, we would have to turn back.
That night we set up camp next to the truck and discussed our approach to the Kamazots. Pretty quickly, we decided on killing them. Tranquilizing the creatures would be especially tough given that there were multiple targets. Also, we didn't really have anywhere else to relocate them to without potentially endangering more people. It would be most efficient and safest to eliminate the aggressive monsters altogether. After the job, we would get in touch with our guides to inform them of the situation and submit our reports. With all of that decided, we settled in for bed. I slept in the truck across the back seats while Ray got into his tent. After an uneventful night, we woke up at first light and had something to eat, and then we packed up and set out for the village again. When we got there, most of the Yanomami were already up and about. Many of them came to greet us, but I saw many wary or even angry looks get cast at our guns and weapons. I imagine that some of the villagers were not too pleased with armed outsiders coming into their home area, which I can certainly understand. Luckily, we did not have to stay long. Ray talked to a few of the old women and some of the warriors we had spoken with yesterday. After some bustling around and discussion, a group of about 10 village men were assembled. Most of them were dressed in only small loincloth, and all of their faces were painted with black lines and dots. Each of them carried a short bow and a quiver made of bark and stalked with arrows slung across their back. A few also held short, fire-hardened spears. Although most of these guys were probably under 5.5 feet tall, they still looked fearsome, and I was moved that so many of them were willing to help us out. "Looks like this is our group of guides. They'll show us to the cave," Ray told me once they came up to us. "Great. I'm guessing they're not coming the whole way?" I asked. Ray nodded. "Correct. They say the cave is on the river nearby. They'll take us as far as the riverbank." With that clarified, Ray told our guides that we were ready, and we set off. At first, we walked down a clear dirt path that led to the Yanomami's crops. These were sets of fields of different vegetables and plants, all located in a big clearing about the same size as the main clearing that held the big Shibono. The warriors and hunters led us past the fields and into the jungle beyond. Instantly, our progress slowed, like roots, rocks, and ground plants got in our way. Weighed down by our packs and our gear, Ray and I were obviously not as fast as the practically naked indigenous. Three of them followed behind us, though, and when the men in front of us got too far ahead, they would stop and wait for us to catch up. The terrain was flat for most of the journey, but with a slight downward slope as we went. The trees and bushes rose high all around, and every so often, the green and brown surroundings would be punctuated by a splash of color from a piece of fungus or a bright poison dart frog. The jungle was filled with noise from the wind and the leaves to the non-stop songs of birds and insects. Once the barking roars of howler monkeys started up from somewhere off to the south and did not stop for about 10 minutes. At one point, one of the guides ahead of us pointed out the long-tailed form of a tree anteater as it clambered up a tree trunk in the distance. Not too long after that, we caught sight of the blue and black beak of a channel-billed toucan in the branches overhead, and at some point, we stepped over a line of leafcutter ants carrying dead bugs and pieces of plants as they marched in a single-file line along the trunk of a fallen tree. After several hours, the tree suddenly parted, and we found ourselves on the muddy banks of a dark, slow-moving river. A flock of scarlet macaws took flight from the treetops on the opposite bank as Ray and I emerged on the forest and approached the water. The guide stopped at the edge of the tree line. This is as far as they were going. This is where they were leaving us, it seemed. Ray exchanged a few words with the group of warriors, and then our guides all raised their weapons to us in a silent salute. Ray turned and motioned for me to follow as he walked upstream. "They say the cave is a short distance this way. They will wait here for us until we come back, or until 3 days pass," Ray told me. "Let's make sure we do come back then," I replied. We walked for about a half an hour more, chatting quietly as we went. After that time, we rounded a bend in the river and came to a place where huge boulders rose on either side of the water. On the same bank as us, a black gap was visible in the cliffs, maybe around 25 feet up, I pointed the dark opening out to Ray, who immediately spat out something in Spanish or Portuguese that sounded like curse. "They might have told us we'd have to climb," he said in English. I gave a laugh at his reaction and took a closer look at the cave entrance. It was taller than it was wide, and although it was narrow and high up, it looked like there were quite a few handholds and footholds leading up to it. "We can definitely get up there," I assured Ray, and he grumbled. "Yeah, okay, but not without something to eat first," he responded. With that, we stopped where we were to have a quick lunch. We did not light a fire to cook anything in case the smell of food spread and attracted the Camazotz. At first, attracting them seemed like a good idea to get a sense of their potential numbers. We did not want any of the monsters flying away. So, in the end, we decided to not try to lure them out. They were all probably in the cave asleep, and that is where we wanted to keep them for now. Ideally, we would climb up to the cave mouth and blast the Camazotz there. It felt nasty to do so, but it would be safer than letting them fly out. As I am sure you have realized by now if you have listened to any of my letters, neither hunters nor monsters fight fair. We fight for survival. After we ate, Ray and I selected our weapons. Since we have to climb, we would be leaving our packs and most of our gear right there at their lunch spot. I settled on my shotgun, since close quarters, stopping power, was what should be important in the situation. Creatures with wings also tend to be less resilient and resistant to damage than other monsters. Even minor injuries to their wings can often compromise their flight capabilities, so I hoped that if any Camazotz managed to start flying, then I would be able to bring them down with a well-placed burst of buckshot. I decided to leave my tomahawk behind in favor of my knives, although my knives did not give me much range or power. I might not even have room in the cave to swing my tomahawk, though. Ray put aside his rifle as well, grabbing his pistols and his own knives instead, and we secured our supplies to a tree along the riverbank and covered them with a tarp to protect them from the rain. With all of that done, we started toward the cave. When we got to the base of the cliffs, it was surprisingly easy to find a climbing route up to the cave. The rocks were uneven and offered plenty of hand and footholds. I slung my shotgun on my back, not the safest gun etiquette, I know, but it left my hands free to climb. As quietly as possible, I began to scale the cliff face, and with Ray right behind me, we made quick progress. But about three quarters of the way up, a nasty stench hit me. It had undercurrents of blood and the heavy odor of something dead, which is difficult to describe. But the main smell was almost like rotting fruit, a weird scent that I had not experienced for a while. For some reason, my mind flashed back to my grandmother's kitchen, and I had a hazy memory of finding some bananas that had gone bad in the trash there. The smell was not overpowering, but it did make me wrinkle my nose. It smelled much worse, but of course it was not a nice smell at all. This odor got worse the higher we got, and before long, I had gotten level with the cave entrance, hanging on to the rocks to see the right side of it. There was no ledge in front of the entrance, so after taking a deep breath, I jumped across the rocks, landing on my feet at the bottom of the cave mouth. The entrance and the few yards directly beyond it were tall enough for me to stand up straight, but it looked like the cave dropped rapidly into a pitch darkness beyond that. The odor was strong, but it seemed fresh. I motioned to Ray to secure a rope to the rocks, if he could, to help us get down more easily. Once he had done that, I signaled for him to wait a second. I stripped on my headlamp, offloaded my shotgun, and flicked the light on. The white light illuminated dark brown stone walls, forming a wide tunnel that continued ahead for a short distance. Dark blotches and drag marks of blood were scattered across the cave walls and floor, and a single yellowed shoulder blade lay discarded part way down the tunnel. But there were no Camazotz. So I stepped back and motioned for Ray to come over into the cave. Once Ray had made the jump, he took a position beside me with his pistols ready. The tunnel was wide enough for us to both walk side by side, so we continued deeper. I felt like my heart was beating with all the force and volume of a bass drum, and I kept feeling like we would get mobbed by beating wings and tooth-filled snouts at any second, but no eyes lit up in the beams of our headlights. And no roars or screeches burst through the quiet. We reached the end of the tunnel, where it took a sharp bend to the left and dropped down a few feet. The cave walls narrowed significantly, leaving room for only one of us to get past at a time. I felt anxiety flare up in my chest at the sight of the narrow passage, and alarm bells started going off in my mind. I never liked caves or other confined spaces. I am not even very claustrophobic, but those type of areas make me very uneasy, especially on hunts. There are just not many ways you can move, and that does not feel good to me. And at that moment, the tight and narrow path ahead seemed like a death trap. I took a deep breath to steady myself, then looked to Ray, who gave me a reassuring nod. After a moment, I stepped down into the tunnel ahead. The walls closed in around me, leaving only a few inches of space to either side. The rotting fruit odor and the smell of blood were thick in the air, and as I slowly moved forward one step at a time, my headlamp revealed more bloodstains and yellow and white bones on the floor. I kept an eye out to see if any of the bones were human, or if there were any scraps of clothing around, but I did not turn anything up. The darkness in front of us seemed to swallow the light of the lamp, but I kept my gun raised and my senses on alert as I advanced. After what felt like forever, the tunnel opened surprisingly and very suddenly. I found myself in a much larger cavern. Stalactites hung from the ceiling and stalagmites rose from the floor among ledges and small piles of stone. Water dripped steadily down from above, where a few cracks and openings in the ceiling let in some isolated shafts of sunlight from outside. A huge pool of water occupied much of the cavern floor. Ray later told me that cave pools like this are called cenotes. In parts of Central and South America, cenotes are often served as swimming pools for tourists, but I would not want to touch this water. It was a murky brown color, and probably full of guano. That is the word for bat poop, if you didn't know. To be fair, the cavern would have been quite peaceful and beautiful if it were not for some of the other details. First, the air was heavy with the strong smell of rotten fruit and blood. Second, the floor of the place was a revolting mess. Piles of dark guano, bloodstains, fur, feathers, and bones of all shapes and sizes lay scattered everywhere across the damp stone floor. And third, hanging down from the ceiling amongst the stalactites, were the sleeping forms of 9 camazots. Like overgrown bats, they grasped a stony cavern ceiling with their claws on their feet and hung upside down with their wings and tails wrapped around their bodies. They were all at least 30 feet above me, but even from that distance my powerful headlamp revealed their dark fur, their oversized pointed ears, and their long snouts. As I stepped into the cavern and took all this in, I froze at the sight of the camazots. I raised a hand and put it out behind me to tell Ray to stop, and then took a few cautious steps forward. My gaze switched between the ceiling and the floor, alternately watching for any movement from the camazots and any obstacles on the ground. Aside from a few ear twitches, none of the monsters moved or seemed to realize that I was even there. Camazots seem to have better eyesight than most bats, so their hearing may not be as sensitive, which was something I was very thankful for in the moment. After a few more quiet steps, I motioned for Ray to come forward. Once Ray and I were in the cavern together, we counted the camazots again and noted their positions. Through careful pantomime and lip-reading, we silently agreed to pull back into the small tunnel behind us the way we had come from if things got too heated. Then we picked our targets. Each of us pointed out 2 camazots. Hopefully, if we shot fast, we might be able to gun down 2 before things got too chaotic. Ray picked out a pair of creatures on the right side of the cavern, and I chose 2 on the left. Mine were only a few feet apart, both dark brown in color and hanging at a similar height. I got as close to them as I felt I could, then looked over to Ray, who gave me the signal to start counting down from 10. I started counting and took aim at the leftmost camazots. As I reached 0 in my head, I fired at nearly the exact same time as Ray. The sound of the gunshots was deafening in the cavern, and almost immediately the gunfire was joined by the sound of beating wings and screeching, chattering camazots. I did not even watch to see if my first shot had hit or killed my target. As soon as I pulled the trigger, I flicked my barrow over to the second. I had picked out and fired again. After my second shot, I distinctively remember seeing the monster I was aiming at plummeting to the ground, but I did not trace its fall. The rest of the cryptids had taken to the air now, flapping around the cavern faster than I had ever expected. I chose one of them and fired at it a few times, but I did not hit it squarely until it landed on one of the cavern walls and held still for just a moment. As I saw it drop, I took a moment to reload and reassess. At least three camazots were still flying around, and one of them started coming toward me, lashing its tail. I jumped backward to give myself more space for a second, ducking as the bone spike at the end of the monster's tail whipped out toward me. I raised my shotgun and fired quickly before breaking for the tunnel entrance. Ray was backing up into the tunnel, firing as he went, and before I got there, he turned and leaped inside. A second later, I dove in after him. We both faced backwards towards the cavern to cover our retreat. A big, gray camazot threw its snout into the tunnel, snapping its huge teeth only a few inches away from me. It staggered backward as Ray sent several shots into its glowing yellow-orange eyes, spraying blood across the walls. I fired a pellet into its face for good measure. Blood and chunks and flesh and brain matter practically exploded across my face, my clothes, and the surrounding stone. What remained of the camazots lurched back into the cavern, twitching and writhing. I felt sick and I could not hear anything except for ringing in my ears. I kept my gun trained on the mouth of the tunnel, but I could not see any movements through it. Ray grabbed my shoulder and pulled me back deeper into the tunnel. Turning to face him, I motioned my ears to indicate that I could not hear, and he nodded. We sat there for a second before the ringing in my ears started to die down a bit. I killed at least three, maybe wounded more. What about you? I asked, my voice sounding muffled in my ears. The same. So we have three left. Are you hurt? Ray asked. I shook my head and was about to ask him the same question when I caught a glimpse of movement in the darkness behind him. The light of my headlamp reflected a pair of glowing yellow eyes. I grabbed Ray's shoulder and pulled him towards me, but the camazot behind him gave an ear-piercing screech and hooked the primary claw of its wings into his back. It yanked him backward and out of my grasp, and I jumped after it. There was no way to get a clear shot. Ray was in between me and the monster, and my shotgun pellets would spread anyway. I think I subconsciously realized this because I dropped my gun and drew my monstrously long combat knife from my hip. The camazots had begun to force Ray to the ground, and I could see it drawing back its tail for a stab. I lunged in and used my free hand to grab the cryptid's tail while I brought my knife upwards and stabbed it in its neck. I felt my blade punch through the fur and sink into the flesh and muscle beneath, and the camazots gave out a gurgling yelp as its hot blood rushed all over my hands. Its tail thrashed round like a hairy python and whipped out of my grasp, stabbing outward at me. I felt the spike at the end of the tail sink into my upper left arm, but I twisted aside and the spike pulled out. The camazot drew back its tail and snapped out at me with its crocodile-like snout, but then a gunshot rang out from underneath it. It was Ray's pistol. The creature fell aside, its huge, leathery wings flapping out and smacking into the sides of the floor of the tunnel. I saw it moving to stand up, but I stepped on one of its wings. The wing hit me a second later, and I stumbled forward, falling to a crouch beside Ray and the camazot's head. The monster bit at me again, but it was way too far away to reach me. I leaned in over its jaws, reversed my grip on the knife, and rammed the weapon into the top of the camazot's head. I drove the blade in as far as I could, pushing through the resistance of its skull until it finally went still. I got shakily to my feet and helped Ray to push the camazot off of him. Ray stood as well, reloading his pistol and cursing under his breath. "My God, this was too damn close," he said after a moment, his voice sounding muffled to my ears after the sound of the gunshot. "How badly are you hurt?" I asked him. "Doesn't hurt too bad. Check for me," Ray said, turning so I could examine the wounds on his back and shoulders. They were bleeding but not too heavily, and they didn't look too deep. "Not too bad. We'll get to them after we're done, if you can manage." I told him and he nodded. "I can hold on. There are only two more left, maybe less. But how did this one get behind us?" Ray asked. I did not know. But the only possibility was is that there was another exit from somewhere in the cavern. We decided to go back into the main cavern, where we hoped the remaining Kamazots would be. As it turned out, we were not disappointed. The cavern was strewn with corpses of the flock, and a single survivor stood alone amongst the carnage. The remaining Kamazots had black fur and was hunched over a dead one with brown fur, its snout buried deep into the corpse as it ate the dead flock member. The sight and sounds of the scene made my stomach turn, and the odor did not help things either. As Ray and I entered the cavern, the surviving Kamazots raised its head to look at us and then made a chattering noise and turned to flee. Its right wing was bleeding heavily, but it bounded forwards with powerful legs and used its left wing to pull itself along the ground in an awkward hopping scramble. I felt bad for it, really. It was just trying to survive, but we could not let it go. Ray ran up and fired at the creature's back a few times, and it crumpled to the floor. All clear, then. Let us count the bodies, I said after taking a short moment of silence. There were 8 dead Kamazots scattered across the cavern floor, along with the one we had killed in the tunnel. That was the entire flock. We had done it. Our next step was even grimmer. Ray and I started to comb the whole cavern in search of the remains of the little girl. I remember hoping the whole time that they had not fallen into the waters of the Senadae. If they were down there, Ray and I had almost no chance of finding her. As we moved towards the rear of the cavern, Ray pointed out a large crack in the wall which was only visible if you looked at it from an angle. It was about 10 feet up the wall and was big enough for a Kamazot to fit into if it folded its wings. Although there was not much point in climbing up to check, both Ray and I agreed that the crack could potentially lead to another opening to the outside. That must have been how the Kamazots from the tunnel got out and flanked around behind us. More importantly, at the rear of the cavern was where we found what we were looking for. The first thing I came across was a small femur. It was still stained with dried blood. My own blood ran cold at the sight, but I crouched down to the damp floor and looked around. There were small chips of bone nearby, held together by dried meat. As I took a closer look, I realized that the smaller bones were that of a left foot. My heart sank. I obviously had not expected to find the girl alive, but that still did not make it any less gut-wrenching to find her remains. I called Ray over, and together we continued scouring the area. In the end, we found almost all of the girl's remains except for some of her teeth, fingers, toes, and pieces of her skull, which the Kamazots had broken open. We even found much of her hair and parts of her clothes. All the bones were almost entirely stripped of flesh. Handling them felt wrong and terrible. We still had several hours of daylight left by the time we brought the first of the remains to the cave entrance. So over the course of a few trips, we brought them all down from the cave and put them in separate bags. Then we returned downriver to the part where the party had been. It was an hour or so before sunset when we got back to our guides, who were sitting around a fire talking with each other. They seemed surprised to see us back, but their expressions quickly hardened and grew solemn when Ray told them of our hunt results. Ray and I brought up the bag containing the girl's remains, and the people built a little sort of shelter out of leaves and branches. We put the bag inside the shelter, which unfortunately did not do much to block out the smell of the cavern that still hung over it. Then we camped nearby for the night. In the morning, we packed up and made our way back to the village. The girl's mother was one of the first to meet us, taking the bag of the girl's remains from us with tears that must have been a mixture of sadness and relief. She kept repeating a phrase to us that Ray told me was an expression of thanks and gratitude. The villagers invited us to stay, but Ray and I declined. We had to get back to an area with a phone to make a report and call in a cleanup crew. So we bid farewell to the people and headed back to Ray's farm. I stayed there for a while more, and we paid the indigenous people around the area a few more visits in that time, and luckily, none of those trips were nearly as eventful as our first. I have been on one other Kamazot's hunt, which I mentioned in an earlier letter as being the largest hunt I have ever been on. In terms of the number of capital H hunters that were actively involved, but that is a story for another time. The hunt that I went on in Brazil with Ray was my first experience with Kamazots, and it was a grim example of how dark hunting can be sometimes. Obviously, it gets far worse as I have talked about in letters like my previous one. But that still does not change how it felt to kill those Kamazots or find that dead little girl. In the end, though, Ray and I did our best to keep people safe. And that is what counts. I have got one more story before I go. Because I'd like to share one of my more meaningful experiences with cryptids. Like my Kamazots hunt in Brazil, this was a situation that was brought on by circumstance and chance more than anything else. Also like that hunt, this one was concerned with the afterlife and the eternal peace and restfulness of a spirit. In this case, it was Heather's spirit. This happened in 2010, only a few months after I killed the Washougue in Quebec. I thought that I had put the whole Heather situation behind me. She had been buried on her family's big plot of land in the Irish countryside, alongside many of her hunter ancestors. I will not tell you where in Ireland her family lives exactly, but it's in the north, immediately adjacent to a large tract of forest and a big pond. The graves are toward the south of the property, and not too far away is a big mound. Heather told me this grassy hill was the home of some local Dina She, aka fairies. According to Heather's family stories, the fairies had inhabited the mound in the forest long before the arrival of humans. When Heather's ancestors had come to the area, these fairy had initially tried to drive them away, but upon realizing that the humans were hunters, they proposed a deal. In exchange for leaving the mound, forest, and pond alone, and for protecting them against more aggressive members of their kind, the fairies allowed the humans to settle on the land and farm it. So Heather's family had lived on the land for a couple of centuries, running the farm and helping protect the local fairy, if they were threatened by either cryptids or humans. I cannot tell you how much of this is true and how much of it is legend, but Heather's family does have a relationship with the fairies that live on their property, and to this day they refuse to touch the woods, the pond, or the mound. Evidently, none of Heather's surviving family members had ever personally seen or spoken to these fairy, but they all knew of their presence and followed the agreement that their ancestors had supposedly made with them. As it happened, this was part of the reason why Heather's uncle and her former guide Callum contacted me in early 2010. Her uncle would rather remain anonymous, so let's just call him Finn. He was a former hunter who had not really been cut out for the job. After a few hunts, he had decided to leave the organization and take over the management of the family farm. The same one that I just talked about. He had lived there with his wife and their children for many years, and none of them ever saw or dealt with these fairies. Shortly before Finn and Callum called me, they were having some issues. As they explained to me, a malevolent and potentially dangerous fairy had recently appeared on the farm. Finn told me that he had not seen anything at first. He had only felt a disturbing sensation when he would venture near the forest or the nearby gravesite. Usually, these had been places of calm and peace, but then Finn had begun to feel like he was being watched when he would go there. Apparently, this was a normal feeling in those areas, but now had become dark and sinister, like there was something else observing him. Something besides the normal fairy inhabitants of the land. Something that Finn called evil. The feelings of being watched by some dark presence had escalated into a full-on dread, making Finn's heart race and his muscles tense. He described feeling like the air had grown heavy and pressing in around him, and a few times he had to turn back to the house. He knew that something was wrong, though, and was determined to get to the bottom of it. One gray and rainy afternoon, he had gone back out to the graves, pushing through the sensations of dread and danger that intensified with every step he took. As he gets closer, he had seen a red light in the distance, which he soon realized was coming from the mound. The little hill was emanating a blood-red glow, Finn said, and he knew somehow that it was a warning. As Finn had turned back, he had heard a booming owl's hoot from the trees, and had turned to see an enormous, spotted brown owl watching him from the forest. According to Finn, the bird was nearly as tall as an adult man, and its eyes glowed an eerie orange, nearly red color. He recognized that this was the presence that had been watching him, and he had immediately run back to the house and called Callum. The two had determined that the owl was a type of fairy known as a macaw. The name macaw refers to one aspect of an ancient Irish goddess of war, battle, fate, and death. In her form as Macaw, this goddess is associated with birds like crows and owls, which is why the hunters call these owl-shaped fairy by their name. In appearance, Macaw fairies appear as gigantic owls or as owl-headed humanoids with feather-covered bodies and talons on their hands. Like what happened with Finn, the presence of a Macaw can cause feelings of extreme dread or even terror, and they seem to drive off other fairies. Macaw is drawn to sites of death, appearing at cemeteries, tombs, and other burial sites anywhere from days to years after someone has been laid to rest there. Although it may sound silly, the locations of Macaw appearances have led to the belief by many people that Macaw devours the souls of the dead. Before leaving, I had prepared as much as I could for what would likely be a fight against a hostile fairy. This consisted of two main things. First, I paid a visit to my weapon maker contacts, who I mentioned in previous letters. They were able to resupply me with plenty of new ammunition for my guns, all of which they had integrated with iron. These fairy in particular hate iron. Its touch burns them, slows them down, and prevents them from doing things like producing light. The second key ingredient in battling fairies is salt. Like an experience I once had, which you may remember if you have listened to my letter about skinwalkers, salt can act as a barrier to certain fairy. For some reason, they usually cannot move past salt if it is scattered on the ground or a windowsill. The touch of salt seems to burn fairies, so I put all my new iron bullets and buckshot pellets into a bucket of salt before I headed out. I also made a few salt bombs, which were just a little plastic pouch that I could throw. Upon contact with something solid, they would split open and scatter salt in a small radius. With these preparations already made when I arrived in Ireland, I had Finn pick me up from the airport and take me right to the farm. As we drove, I asked him to update me on the current situation. Not much had changed, though. The red light from the ferry mount had faded, and the last night there had been a thunderstorm that had shaken the house quite literally. A few times, Finn said that he had glimpsed the macaw's glowing eyes or its huge shadow near the house through the rain. It had not hurt anyone physically, but Finn said that he and his family were all experiencing the feelings of dread constantly now, even when they were in the house. He had felt scared just walking to the car from the front door. He started to cry when he told me all of this, and although he did not mention Heather or the Graves, I knew he was terrified about their well-being too. I made a silent promise to myself that I would not give up on this mission, no matter what. Not long after this, we arrived at the farm. It was still early in the evening, but the sky overhead was almost pitch black. It almost looked like the middle of the night, but with no stars or moon, it was raining lightly. And before I even stepped out of the car, I could feel what Finn had described earlier. The air felt too heavy and close, like it was pressing in on everything. More than that, something just felt off. Something felt wrong somehow. The sensation of being watched hit me soon after that, and although I know it well, it still made me shiver. "What do you think?" Finn asked quietly after I stood outside the car for a moment. "I don't like it, but I'll do my best to stop it," I answered, telling the truth as best as I could. I went to grab my stuff in the back of the car. Finn moved to help, but I waved him off. I was going to go right in. I had a sense that it was not going to take awfully long. In hindsight, I should have taken Finn's offer to go inside first. I was hungry and tired, and in the house I would have been able to get something to eat and take a nap before heading out. The house was surrounded by a circle of salt, so it was a safe place to rest, but I had the feeling that I needed to go right at that very moment. It was an overwhelming instinct that was telling me to deal with the macaw instantly, so I did not stop to rest. I just started gearing up. It did not take long to get together everything I needed. I had packed my tomahawk and my ammo in my box of salt, so I took those out and started loading up. When that was done, I arranged my little salt bombs at my belt and started off towards the graves, leaving behind anything that would not be necessary for combat or basic wound treatment. It was not before the woods rose on my left side, some of the trees just starting to grow their leaves again after winter. I took a second to peer through the rain in that direction, but although I felt that something was there, I didn't see anything. As I kept going, the feeling that something was wrong began to intensify and the pressure in the air got heavier. Eventually, in the distance, I caught sight of the mound. It was a little more than a shadow through the rain, but I knew from previous visits that it was indeed the mound that I was trying to find. My head started to spin at the sight, but I kept moving. The dirt path under my feet turned into a muddy mess long ago, and each step I took made it just a tiny bit harder to slog through the water and the muck. At some point, the graves came into view. Not too far away from the foot of the mound, the gravesite is simple, consisting of just a collection of maybe 60 tombstones surrounded by a low wooden fence. The few times I had been here before had all been to visit Heather's grave, so I knew where hers was located. As I got closer, though, it began getting harder to breathe, and I gradually started to feel like I should not be here. I knew it was probably just the Makuz presence affecting me, but the urge to turn back soon grew almost overwhelming. I stopped walking and tried to take a deep breath, but I could not. A feeling of helplessness washed over me with a physical chill. Then I thought of two things. First, I remembered the promise I made while driving to the farm with Finn. I told myself that I was not going to give up on this mission, and I wanted to hold to that. And second, I had an image come into my mind. It was a vision of Heather's eyes in the minutes before her death. Her eyes had been so calm, just like she herself had been throughout all of our hunts. Even today, I try to channel that level of calm and peace. If she could possess that while only moments away from the end of her life, then I could at least try to replicate it. I do not know much about spirits or souls or the afterlife, but most of my family believes that they exist. In fact, one of the charms that I wear on my hunch was specifically crafted to connect me with the souls of my ancestors and link their favor and protection to me. And on that day, I really do believe that they and Heather were watching over me, wherever they are. I felt for a moment like I did when hunting with Heather, and more than before, I felt that I had to protect her like I could not do before. I was able to breathe and move again, and I pressed on. Soon I had reached the fence around the grave site, and I opened the little door to the grave entrance. When I stepped inside, the weight in the air seemed to lessen, and I felt better. I took a quick look around, but did not see anything out of the ordinary. Finn told me he had not been able to bring himself to the graves ever since he had seen this fairy, so he had not salted around the area. That was fine for me. I wanted to draw this thing out. I had a sense that the graves would be the best place for that. I doubted that this monster would be foolish enough to approach a human with a firearm if there were also a barrier of salt in the way. Finn had said that he had seen this thing at the edge of the tree line multiple times, and my instincts told me that it was somewhere in that direction. I felt anxious but ready, so I took up a position at the entrance of the gravesite, and I waited. Because of the black sky overhead, I had no idea of the passage of time from the sun or the light. I mainly just remember keeping a surprisingly level head during that time. Sometimes I can get lost in my thoughts or feelings during long periods of inactivity on hunts, although over time I have gotten better at being in the moment and focusing on the present. On that hunt in Ireland, I remember keeping very calm while waiting for this fairy. A lot of emotions and thoughts came up, of course, but I did not let them derail me. Although I felt sad and scared and I missed Heather immensely, I mostly felt determined. I was going to see this through. After what had been a few hours, the sky darkened even more and the rain had intensified a little bit more. There had been a few rumbles of thunder, and in the distance, the sky had lit up with lightning a couple of times. At some point, the weight of the air around me had started to increase noticeably. Then, I heard a series of owls' hoots from the woods to the east. The sound of owls hooting is usually cool to me, for the lack of a better word. It is related to my name, after all. But the call of this thing was eerie. It was much too deep in pitch, and it boomed like a drum. A moment after the hooting, I saw a pair of orange-red eyes flare into view at the top of a small dead tree. There it was. Its body seemed to fade into a view a moment later. Finn's description was accurate. The fairy appeared just like an enormous owl, its feathers speckled in various shades of brown. Two feathery tufts stuck straight up from the sides of its head like horns, and I could practically see the danger and dark intention in its eyes. As strange as that might sound, this thing stared at me for a long moment, and eventually I chose to make the first move. Never breaking eye contact, I stepped forward to speak. This type of fairy are mostly highly intelligent, and are usually just as smart as humans. Most can also speak. Hunters have observed fairies speaking to each other in their own language, but many of them also communicate with English, Gaelic, and other languages that humans use. Their intelligence and power of speech mean that fairies can be negotiated with most of the time. In fact, there are hunters who specialize in dealing with the fae. They act more like diplomats than fighters. With all of this in mind, I decided to try to talk to the thing. Maybe that was stupid, but I always try to avoid bloodshed if possible, and I figured that there was a good chance that this fairy would at least understand me. I felt a little silly as I began speaking, but I did not stop. I cannot remember exactly what I said, but it was something along these lines. "Hello. My name is Sam White Owl. I'm a hunter. My duty is to keep a balance between humans and beings like yourself. The people of this place have an agreement with the local fairy who live here. I am here to uphold that agreement and protect all of them," I said. The creature did not respond, and again I felt ridiculous. What was I even doing? Then, it flapped its wings and flew forward. Tendrils of mist and rain twisted from its wings and tail, trailing behind it as it moved. I held my ground, ready to use my shotgun, but the monster did not attack. It swooped down and landed on the fence about 50 feet away, shaking the wooden post. It locked its eyes with mine again, and for a second time I tried talking to it. "I don't know why you've come, but I won't let you hurt anyone, living or dead. Please go. I have no wish to fight you, but I will if I must. Go. Go and we can live in peace," I said, trying not to raise my voice anymore. It spread its wings wide, revealing streaks of rust-covered feathers on their undersides. It did not open its black beak, but I very clearly heard three words, as if the creature had spoken words back to me. "Leave this place." The voice was calm but firm and stern. Its words were unmistakable, but I could not do what they said. "I can't. You know this. I'm sorry. I do not want violence. Go, please," I repeated, getting ready to raise my gun again. The fairy paused for a moment, then opened its beak and gave an ear-splitting screech, raspy and piercing. I winced and nearly dropped my shotgun to cover my ears from the painful sound. With a single, powerful flap of its wings, it surged forwards at me, surprisingly fast for a creature of its size. Quickly, I took aim, and a second later, when the fairy was on top of me, I fired. In an instant, before I pulled the trigger, this thing veered to the side, and my shot missed completely. I swung my barrel and turned, trying to find my target again just before it hit me. I caught a glimpse of brown feathers and fired again. The fairy let out a cry of pain and crashed into me. I went tumbling backward, feeling this thing's sharp talons tear into my forearms through my jacket. But I had thrown off the fairy's attack, and the wounds were not deep. I hit the ground on my back, keeping a tight grip on my gun. The maka was now over me, trying to grasp my arms with the vice grip of its talons. I was able to jerk one arm free and use it to grab the salt bomb from my belt. This thing brought its beak down at my face, but I leaned my head to the side and smashed the salt bomb into its feathered face. The package burst open, spraying grains of salt across the face and mine as well, but of course, this only hurt one of us. It flapped backward, battering me with its wings in the process. It was coughing, giving loud, booming exhalations as it jetted up into the air, like the reaction of walkers to blessed ash or werewolves to silver. The salt had burned the fairy. Clouds of gray smoke or steam were billowing out from the side of its face where I had slammed the salt bomb. Ignoring the pain in my arms, I raised my shotgun and started shooting. It was flapping erratically, moving unpredictably from side to side vertically, so I never landed a direct hit, but I did see a few more plumes of smoke erupt across its wings when my iron pellets hit it. After one of these shots, the cryptid gave a short screech and went down, falling to the side and hitting the ground with one big audible thump. A tombstone was between me and the huge cloud of steam that was fuming up from this thing. The smoke cloud was blocking my vision of the cryptid, and the tombstone blocked me from getting a shot, so I ran to the side to get a better angle. As I moved, the steam cloud billowed and shifted, and as I stopped to take aim at it, it rushed at me once more. It had shifted forms. Now, instead of a huge owl, it was in the shape of a humanoid figure with an owl's head and a body covered in feathers. Its hands ended in huge talons, and its wounds still trailed smoke as it came. I had been expecting this thing to come around either side of the tombstone, but instead it leaped over the obstacle before I had time to adjust my aim. My first shot went wide, and my second went off harmlessly into the air, as this thing reached me and yanked the gun barrel aside with one taloned hand. The fairy was stronger than its relatively lanky new shape appeared, and it grasped my gun with both hands and tore it away from me with little effort. I sprang backwards, grasping to pull my tomahawk out of the sheath that hung on my back. Either the Maka did not know how to use a shotgun, or its talons prevented it from doing so. Either way, it moved in on me fast, swinging the gun by the barrel like a club in one hand and slashing with its talons at me with the other hand. One of its talon swipes caught me across the face, slicing shallow gashes across my cheek and chin, but I managed to duck the rest of its swings and pull out my tomahawk. It was unrelenting, giving me no opening to strike. I used the handle of the tomahawk to block this thing's makeshift club, and each time I caught one of its strikes, the collision sent a shockwave through my arms, rattling me. There was no opening for me to retaliate, and I was getting tired fast. Just then, there was a bright flash of light from behind me. I realized it had come from the mound. It was so bright that it temporarily blinded me. Judging by this thing's screech, it sounded like it was blinded as well, and when my vision returned, I was staggering backwards, and so was this thing. The fairies of the farm had helped me, and this was my chance to repay them. I stepped in on it and swung my tomahawk as hard as I could with both hands, aiming squarely for its neck. I landed the hit exactly, slashing through its neck in a spray of blood and smoke. I stepped back, pulling the tomahawk free, and the corpse toppled to the muddy ground, steam pouring from it. I took a deep breath of relief as I stepped back from the fallen fairy, waving smoke out of my face. The white cloud of fumes totally enveloped the thing's body, and only at this point did it strike me that the steam had no real smell. Maybe the rain was dulling whatever scent it may have had. Who knows? In any case, I watched as the smoke cloud began to rise, and with it, an eerie, beautiful sight. A soft blue glow slowly came to life from within the cloud, and then a very distinct orb of this light slowly rose from the fallen form. I blinked a couple of times, and one of these times I swore that I saw a pale silhouette of the owl's form, clutching the ball of light in its talons. An instant later, the image was gone, but the spear of light remained, continuing to float slowly upwards. When it was about 10 feet above the ground, the light stopped and I got the feeling of being watched again. This time, though, there was none of that dread and hostility I felt earlier. Now the feeling just seemed neutral. Then I heard the thing's voice again, as clear and as calm as it had been the first time. Now, however, it seemed almost approving.
"Well fought, White Owl."
Then the orb of light darted forward, sailing overhead. I watched as it soared toward the mound, circled it once, and then plunged down into it, vanishing from sight. I felt the weight in the air lift, and all the prior feelings of fear and darkness lifted with it. The sky was still black, and the rain showed no signs of stopping, but I could feel that I had done it. The farm and everyone on it, living and dead, human and monster, were safe. I still do not know the meaning of the blue light that I saw rise from the thing's body. I have told quite a few people about it and made sure to note it in my report on the whole situation. The same thing has been reported before with other types of fairy. The general conclusion that people seem to come with, which I agree, is that the light was intangible. It was a representation of the thing's presence. You might even call it a spirit or a soul. As for why it flew into the fairy mound, I do not think anyone knows for sure, except maybe the inhabitants of the mounds themselves. My best guess is that something was left of it, and it integrated itself into the population of the fairy that live on the farm. Maybe it felt like it owed them, or maybe it had nowhere else to go. Whatever the case may be, Finn says everything is calm on the farm, so it looks like everything is still getting along. In the time right after I killed the macaw and saw the light, I went over to the fence and leaned on it to put some bandages on my wounds and to stop the bleeding. All the wounds were quite shallow, but it took a while to staunch the blood. I felt exhausted and a little lightheaded, but before I staggered back to the house, I did two things first. First, I turned to the mound and bowed my head to it before calling out to whoever might be listening there. "You saved my life, and thank you for protecting me as I try to protect you," I said. There was no response, but for some reason I felt like my words had been heard. I waved farewell to the mound and went to do the second thing I wanted to. Slowly I moved to the back of the gravesite and found the thin, vertical rectangle that was Heather's tombstone. I knelt on the wet grass in front of it and took my usual second to breathe and connect before I started speaking. To be totally honest, I do not remember exactly what I said to Heather on that occasion. I think I got emotional and did not write much down in my journal about it afterward, but I thanked her for continuing to guide, inspire, and strengthen me in all my hunts. I gave her a quick life update and checked in with her about my feelings, and I expressed my gratitude for being able to protect her from the macaw. It, of course, did not make up for the failing to protect her from the Wushuge, but I was doing my best, which I know she understood. Finally, when I was done, I took a moment of silence before saying goodbye with the phrase we used to end our phone calls with. The same phrase I usually put at the end of these letters. "Thanks, Heather. I love you. We'll talk more soon," I said quietly to her. I took one more moment to be silent and feel the warmth and peace of connecting with Heather again. Then I stood, picked up all my weapons, and made my way back to the house. Finn called Callum and a cleanup crew, and he and his wife started treating my wounds. I stayed passed out on the farm for a couple more days, but eventually I recovered enough to bid them farewell and return to the States. After that, I guess you already know the rest of my story. Eventually I met Serena, started training my nephew, and have not stopped hunting since. As I get close to retiring, it has been good to look back on where I have been. Coming back to Swamp Dweller has offered me a unique chance to do that, and both he and every one of you have been very vital in helping me to share my stories and information. It has had a bigger impact than I ever expected, so I want to thank you all for making that happen. I hope what I have shared can help keep you safe, or inspire you, or at the very least make you a bit more aware. It has been a pleasure sharing with you. I've got plenty more stories, but at least for now, this is goodbye. So thank you again, and much love to you all. I hope you continue staying safe from cryptids, pandemics, depression, and whatever else. I hope we will talk soon. And this has been Sam White Owl, signing out.